Okay, thank you for having me. Thank you for coming. So far, it's been great fun and very tasty. I enjoyed yeah, so actually, just a short background story. This is one of those projects I didn't thought I'll be working on when arriving for Berkeley, but there was a talk about a work from, also Curly is involved in it, about the Axon Basin, who ignited this whole thing, and then we realized that there is maybe something interesting to say, and this is what I'm trying to get at. This is the backstory for what I'm going to explain today, but I really think it's going to be kind of a shorter talk because I didn't want to go into unnecessary details of how we did some of the calculation because all of them are kind of simple, but feel free to ask for details because we will have time for that, I think, I hope. So, just for today, what is my definition of an axion? And this is my axion slide because I'm not going to motivate the axion, especially because usually people say, okay, it's the QCD axion. But I'm not going to talk about a QCD axion, right? I'm going to talk about an axion-like particles, and I'm not going to say axion-like particle because it is three words, and I prefer just saying the axion. The QCD axion will appear on my parameter space, but I'm not going to touch it with my constraints. So I'm going to talk about this Lagrangian, and you could ask, okay, why don't you have different, why don't you include, okay, so let's just say, right, so there is the kinetic term, the mass term, and then the coupling, the axion photon coupling, and the axion electron coupling, and then you can ask, why don't you have other couplings? And the reason is that they don't play any role. I'm going to talk about, well, it depends who you are. Early cosmology, if you're an astrophysicist, late cosmology, if you're doing inflationary models in your life. But I'm going to talk about the epoch that is just around BBN. And during this time, the only other interaction that might play a role is the coupling to neutrinos. But we know that those should be very much suppressed compared to this one. You should expect something that, right, so this coupling is roughly given by one over, sorry, the electron mass over FA. And for the neutrino, you expect to see something like the neutrino mass over FA, which is going to be much smaller. And if we include it, it doesn't change any of the conclusions that we're going to talk about. So for today's talk, I think that this is the most Lagrangian that I need to consider. And because it is so general, I'm going to drop one term. Oops, sorry. Yes, I'm going to drop this term for the first parts of this talk, and I'll reintroduce it later. And this is sometimes referred to as the photophilic axion. Right, so this is also a strange thing, right? If it couples to photons, it is photophilic. But if it doesn't, sorry, but if it coupled to electron, it is photophobic. Why don't you call it electrophilic also? I don't know. People are just negative. So this is the parameter space I'm going to talk about, right? So this is the axion mass versus the axion coupling, and you put an absolute value here because it doesn't matter when you have only this coupling, when you have both of them. There might be some cancellations at the loop level, but I don't think I'm going to show any slide regarding this. But the thing is that for the observables we are talking about at this part of this talk, the sign doesn't matter, so you can just talk about the absolute value of the coupling. And if you have a QCD axion through the DFSZ or KSVZ models, then it will sit on this part of the parameter space. And now I'm going to add known constraints on this parameter space, and I'm going to divide them into constraints that require the axion to be dark matter and constraints that do not, right? So if the axion is part of our spectrum, it exists in the universe, it can be produced in all sorts of systems. Specifically, there are astrophysical systems in which you expect the axion to be produced. So the lighter it is, the easier it is to produce it in systems with all sorts of temperature. And these are the constraints coming from production at various astrophysical systems. So you have this region, for example, or all that region basically is covered by production at horizontal branch styles. So you constrain overcooling just constrain additional cooling mechanism in those styles, because if you produce axions, they would escape and cool down the styles. And here you have cooling from, in this part of the parameter space, you have cooling from production of axions, sorry, constraints from production of axions in supernova explosions. And this little dimple is the solar basin, which is an amazing idea, where if you produce some of those axions in the sun, some of them, well, they are produced with some kind of velocity distribution, and some of them will be slow enough to not be able to escape from the gravitational potential of the sun. And then they accumulate around the sun and can decay into photons. And Curley and his friends did this analysis and looked for the photons, and they were able to put these constraints. And basically, this dimple is the thing that had us wondering whether this parameter space is actually open. And the reason we asked this, okay, so in a second, I'll say what is the intuition for why we thought that this region might be constrained. So now, if you add another assumption, which is that those axion-like particles actually make up for the dark matter density, you could have additional constraints. So first of all, inside halos, you have the what they call haloscope constraints, right? So you have a large density of dark matter around you. Some of it will be, and some of it could reach experiments here on Earth. And you have experiments with strong magnetic fields that would allow for the axion to be converted into photons. And then you try and measure those photons in the lab, and you get those kind of constraints depending on the experiment that you are looking at. But the thing that had us thinking about whether or not this parameter space is actually available are the constraints coming from cosmology. Well, cosmology and astrophysics in some sense. So those constraints are coming, right? So the best constraints that we get here are coming from axion decays into photons in the Milky Way. Right, and the reason the constraints are so good in the Milky Way is because when something decays in the Milky Way or in the Z equals zero universe, the thing you observe is a line, right? So you can look for a line instead of a broadened signal, and then your telescopes have great sensitivity. And the best demonstration of this is these constraints coming from the XMM Newton telescope, where they did a very thorough search through the measurements of this telescope. And it is nice because it sits just below the solar basin. So we thought, okay, you have so strong X-ray constraints on the lifetime of the axion in the Milky Way, assuming that it is dark matter. Specifically in this region where you have something like the solar basin. So the thing, okay, so maybe before going to motivate our paper, I'll just add one more thing. So we have here decays from constraints from decay in the Z equals zero universe, but you could also, you have in this region also constraints coming from cosmological constraints on the, sorry, local measurements today of the axion background, right? So you have axions in cosmology and they decay throughout the lifetime of the universe, and you could decay and you could measure the those photons, and we'll talk about it later. You also have constraints here from CMB anisotropies, CMB spectral distortions, and effective BBM. But basically the thing I'm going to focus about now is this very low line, like the absolute best constraints that you get in this mass range coming from mainly X-ray searches. And right, so if I'm telling you that the constraint on dark matter decaying in our galaxy is so much better than astrophysical searches, the thing that had us wondering is, the thing that we were thinking about is how dilute should dark matter be, right? So how small fraction does the axion have to make of the total dark matter density before those constraints are weaker than the astrophysical constraints? And I'm going to explain this sentence because I think it came out a bit vague, but I'll explain it in a second. So basically, I'm going to give a small spoiler, and I'll be able to tell you that even if you take the most conservative assumptions about the cosmological history of our universe, you can still get those nice constraints, and we will talk about each and every component of this blue region, even without assuming that axion is your dark matter. So these are coming from X-ray decays. This comes from CMB anisotropies. You have spectral distortions and a little BBN bound over there. But to explain how come this thing comes about, we just note again that there is something like six orders of magnitude between the coupling that are constrained by X-ray, assuming axion is dark matter, and the absolute best astrophysical constraints that we get just from production of the axion. So yeah, okay, I already told Cliff about it. I was very pleased about this joke, and I copy it and I send it to one of my collaborators, being very proud of this wonderful joke, and he really liked it. This is a Nicrode at CERN currently, and he really liked it, but he decided to do what I didn't, which is Googling axion homeopathy. And of course, there is a paper by Cliff titled Axion Homeopathy. I'm like, okay, usually we are scooped by Russians in the 40s, but now I was scooped by someone actually attending my seminar, yeah, on a joke, right? right. Yeah, good. So the question is, how dilute is too dilute? And that's what made me think of axion homeopathy. Good. So we have six orders of magnitude between the constraints, right? So the constraints coming from the basin is that the axion coupling should be smaller than this number, G basin, I call it here, which is six orders of magnitude stronger than the constraints coming from XMM Newton, assuming axion is dark matter. But as we just said, as I'm going to say now, actually, the constraints from XMM Newton constrain the flux of photons coming from axion decays. So the thing that we constrain is the decay rate of axion times the density, the number density of axions. And the decay rate of the axion scales like g squared times m cubed. So this whole constraint scales like g squared, mass squared, times the density of axions. Now, if I'm just rearranging this equation, I can write that given the constraint, assuming this is dark matter, I get an upper bound on rho, the density of axion, times the coupling of axion, because both of them would scale the same with the mass of the axion. Now, focusing specifically on 10 keV, which is the region where both XMM and the basin are doing the best job, I can write it as the fraction of dark matter in axions, right? So rho A over rho dm is like the fraction of dark matter that is actually in axion, should be smaller than gxmm squared over g alpha squared, right? This is just rearranging this equation, and which is given by 10 to the minus 12 g basin over g a gamma gamma squared, right? So what do we learn by this simple exercise? That as long, so if I want to never worry about X-ray constraints on the decay of axions with coupling as high as the one allowed by the basin, I need it to be dilute, so dilute that it makes less than 10 to the minus 12 of the dark matter mass density in our galaxy. Right? So you need to not produce any axions, basically, throughout cosmology. Is this point clear? Because this is the, I mean, here I can stop and then you can just go and set the rescale the constraints, because this is the only thing that you should think about, right? The thing that we constrain is the lifetime times the density. We can then manipulate it to be a constraint on the density given the coupling. And we know that the constraint should scale like gxmm over g, the actual coupling squared. And if we just plug in the number, we know that for ga gamma gamma larger than those basin coupling, we are not constrained. So if we are at the boundary, we need to dilute it to one part in 10 to the 12. So we need it to be extremely dilute. Okay. So the question is it possible? And the bottom line of our paper is that within this parameter space, you will always have some irreducible background that is constrained by X-ray searches, which is the reason we were able to, well, not only X-ray, but also CMB anisotropies, et cetera, which is the thing that we're going to discuss. Good. Any questions so far? So now let's make some definitions. So the reason we have some irreducible axion background is because of the freezing mechanism. And what is the freezing mechanism? You basically start with some sector that can decay and produce axion out of equilibrium, and you let the density grow, but the density never grows enough such that the axion get a thermal distribution, right? Because if they gain thermal distribution, they would maintain thermal equilibrium with whatever brought it into existence, and then we say it freezes out. But if you just start with something that can decay into axion and populate the axion density, it grows until it stops growing, then we say it grows in. Yeah, we call it freezing. good. So what happens is that the density grows because of the decays, and then at some later point, which for us is always sufficiently later, the axions start decay at the axion lifetime, and then the density just depletes exponentially. Okay? So the reason that we have some freezing contribution when we only assume axion photon coupling is those three different processes. So this is sometimes called the Primakov process, where we convert a photon into an axion. There is also photons inverse decays, right? I can have all photon fusion. And we also have annihilations. Electron positron pair from the plasma is annihilating into an axion photon pair. And one thing we want to know about those processes is that those two contribute to UV freezing, and this process contributes only to IR freezing. It is a statement about the dimension of the effective operator that mediates this process versus those two. And by UV and IR freezing, I mean that the UV freezing is independent of my initial condition. The UV is dependent on my initial condition, and IR isn't. So what do we do with processes that depend on the initial conditions? If we try to form an irreducible contribution, we want to be ridiculously conservative or aggressive, depending if you are the axion or the constraint. So what do we do? We assume that we know that by observation of light elements, we know that PBN must occur at around 5 MeV, and we must reheat, bring the universe into radiation dominated by roughly 5 MeV. Some people claim that you can go all the way to 2 MeV. Some people claim that you need to reheat before 10 MeV. But this is the ballpark, and we're not going to be extremely sensitive to the precise number. So hereafter, we're just gonna assume that the universe had some, we don't really going to assume much about what happened prior to that, but we just assume that the universe had a temperature at 5 MeV at 5 MeV, and before that we don't assume anything. So basically the initial condition that we say, that we assume, is that there are absolutely no axions at 5 MeV, because we know how to evolve the universe conservatively starting from the temperature of 5 MeV onward. Okay, so this is how we formulate the irreducible contribution to the axion abundance. And now, yes, I'm going to show some plots in the end, but I'll also mention the scaling of things, but yeah. Yeah, right, so if, because we never reach into equilibrium, I can always look at the freezing process as I can look at the freezing from this epoch, that epoch. So if I do anything before 5 MeV, it would just be on top of this thing. Good. So just in terms of notation, we decided to formulate everything in terms of this FA, the axion fraction, which is basically the ratio of number density of axions, assuming it didn't decay. This is the dashed line, right? So I have some axion freezing. It fixes the number density of axions once they become non-relativistic, and then they decay. But assuming they hadn't decay, this would have been the ratio, right? And because the freezing and the decay happens on such different epochs, it's a very simple calculation. I mean, you don't need to really work hard. You just solve the freezing equation, taking the time to infinity. without considering the back reaction, without considering the decay of axion, right? So FA is simply the axion fraction in the universe, fraction by mass, okay, not by number. So this is number density times mass, so this is like the non-relativistic density. Good. And then we can go and actually do the freezing calculation. And as I said, because we never care about the back reaction, because we never reach thermal equilibrium, we can look at each of the processes separately. And first we can look at this Primakov process, so the photon conversion, and it gives me this number, right? So this is roughly the parameter space that we are going to be interested in. And I'm going to claim shortly that above 10 to the minus 7, we do reach equilibrium, and then the consideration, the calculation slightly changed. So our calculation are basically trustworthy only below 10 to the minus 7. Right, and this is roughly the numbers that we talk about. We get to an axion fraction of 1 at this parameter region, which means that here the axion fraction is more than 1, but the lifetime is so short here that it never overcloses, right? So we don't need to worry about overclosure in this case. Good. The next diagram we include now is the inverse decays, and we see that roughly at 100 keV, inverse decay take over. Oh, sorry, I didn't mention the reason we have this exponential turn off is because at some point the axion mass crosses the reheat temperature of 5 MeV, and then you pay a Boltzmann suppression when you try to introduce it. It's only the tail of the distribution can produce on-shell axions, so that's the reason for this exponential decay. But because exponents are fast only, you're far away from where the exponent is 1, I don't know if this means anything, we will actually be able to probe axion mass of like 50 MeV, even though the temperature, the highest temperature we consider is 5 MeV, but we'll get to it shortly, right? So
relevant the momentum the axions can be produced, because when you assume that axions are all of the dark matter, you assume that they are like
cold.
Real CM cold, etc. But these guys are not necessarily cold, right? For instance, freezing dark matter, like
yes, so I will mention one place at which it makes a difference, and there is one constraint that we decided to throw away because we were not sure about it. But for other things, the decays happen. The decay happens late enough such that the energy is basically given by their mass. Right, so you care only about the number density.
But that's my question precisely. Is the number density, can you just rescale the number density from the number density of CDN? In the sense that, for instance, if these guys have high momentum,
They don't have a high momentum, right? So that's what I'm saying. That except for, there is one exception that I'm going to mention, but and I'm not going to show these constraints on our plot because of it, but usually what happens is that it decays while non-relativistic. Right, so the constraints are coming from decays that are non-relativistic, and the only one place at which we had to take this consideration into account is the question whether they behave as cold or warm dark matter. And okay, I'll get to it later. Okay, they don't collapse, but there are simulation of. We'll get to it in a moment. Okay, and I didn't add a plot, but I can show a plot where we. There is a nice simulation that solved this problem for us, but that's it will not collapse into small structure.
Sure, but there's still, you know, the other cold dark matter, which is most of the dark matter. Because they want to set, for instance, constraints for me.
Right.
Yeah.
So that is exactly the thing, that we don't think it's going to collapse into satellite galaxies. But there are, so because we're talking about it already, no, I'm not going to let you lead the talk. I'll be the leader. I'll get to it later. Good. Next diagram, inverse decay. Yes, good. So as we, because freezing is, all our calculations assume, and we verify that this is self-consistent, that freezing has already ended. Right, so the axion density is already fixed when we start doing the calculation. The only thing we will have to worry about is to address it with an exponential decay, and I'll get to it. Okay. So the second contribution, as I said, is the photon fusion or inverse decays, and we see that they become the dominant process at roughly 100 keV. And the last process, which is the annihilation, is always subdominant, right? So if we were able to dial down the reheat temperature by two extra orders of magnitude, then this process, which is the only IR one, would probably be stronger than those. But within our universe, annihilations in this case never dominate the production of axion density. So now let me show the total, the sum of all contributions. So this is the line where f equals 1. Well, above this line, there is a point in time where axion makes more. Well, omega axion is going to be larger than omega dark matter. It never causes overclosure because it decays fast enough, and it doesn't modify matter radiation equality. So it always decays in this parameter region. It always decays before matter radiation equality. So it doesn't do anything specifically. It could leave some spectral distortion, because spectral distortions are set at very early epoch, but just doesn't in this case. Okay, sorry. So I wanted to say something. Yeah, right. So as I said earlier, equilibrium is reached, right? So the axion can reach equilibrium with the standard model only for coupling larger than roughly 10 to the minus 7 GeV for this reheat temperature. And one thing that I wanted to add is that axions are non-relativistic today, so you actually need to dress up the actual density of axions is given by the dark matter density times this fraction FA, which is defined as this ratio. And we dress it up with this exponent, e to the minus t. This is like the age of the universe at a specific time, divided by the axion lifetime. And in principle, you might wanna add, right? So in principle, you might wanna do something like a different factor, something like e to the minus t freezing over the lifetime of the axion, if you wanna be pedantic, right? Because this FA is set when the axion has already stopped accumulating. But this thing is so much smaller than any time that we are talking about, so we just don't include it. Okay? I don't know if this adds confusions, but if it confuses you, just forget about it. So then it's not an important thing, but we did check it. Good. So now, let's try and constrain this irreducible axion background, the decays of such irreducible axion background. And I'm just focusing on this region of parameter space now, okay? So it is between 10 eV and here it's like 100 MeV. 1000 MeV? No, 100 MeV. I'm confused. This is MeV, yeah, 100 MeV, good. And first, I want to discuss what happens with local decays at the z equals 0 universe. So as we said, we can look for lines, and this is the reason those constraints are really good. And what I said a few slides ago is the thing that we constrain is that is the density of axion divided by the lifetime should be smaller than the dark matter density divided by some minimum lifetime that those experiments are sensitive to, assuming that what they measure is the entirety of dark matter decay to. So this would give us a constraint of the form, the fraction of axions should be smaller by the lifetime of the axion divided by the lifetime, the constraint on the lifetime, assuming it was the entirety of dark matter. And as a number to keep in mind, those local searches for dark matter decays usually constrain the dark matter lifetime to be larger than roughly 10 to the 28 seconds. This is like a ballpark to keep in mind. So if we go and just plot this line, this is using the freezing calculation that we just did, we would cover something like this part of the parameter space. But as we just said, in order for them to be observed locally, they have to survive until today. So their lifetime needs to be larger than the age of the universe. So if we just cut the parameter space at the age of the universe, then we get this tiny wedge. Okay? But if instead of cutting it aggressively, we bring back this exponential factor, we get a slightly larger parameter space, which looks like this, roughly. So the turnaround happens around the lifetime, around the axion lifetime equals the age of the universe. And now if we, so this is the constraint, assuming a mass-independent constraint of 10 to the 28 second, but if we actually use experimental data, then this is the constraint that we get, the shaded region, the shaded blue region, which comes from a bunch of experiment I'll detail about in a second. And we just add the actual lines, assuming a mass-independent lifetime of 10 to the 28, 29, and 30 seconds. Okay? So there are constraints that already reach the 10 to the, even cross a bit, the 10 to the 29 seconds, using local X-ray, sorry, assuming local decays into in the X-ray band. So now you might be able to see that the lines here have like a very mellow turnaround, roughly around here, right? Like a few tens of keV's. And this is basically the warm dark matter effect that we expect. And how did we get to this scaling of things? There have been, in the days where warm dark matter was a popular idea, people ran N-body simulations, assuming you have a cold dark matter with some warm component, right? And we could get the effective warm dark matter temperature of this axion fraction and use their simulation to roughly know what would be the suppression to the dark matter density in a Milky Way-like halo as a function of the mass and the radius, the galactic radius. Right, so basically, I'm not gonna tell you what the numbers are, but what they got, let's write it here. So what they got is that for them it was rho, warm dark matter over rho CDM as a function of galactic radius equals the cosmological ratio. Times 1 minus r to some power times the mass over kV squared plus to the minus 1. Okay, so they will, and this is, was given in r over kPc to some power that I don't remember right now. And as you'd expect, as you dial down this number, this factor becomes independent of the cosmological ratio, right? Because the less warm dark matter you have, right? So when you have just one warm dark matter particle, it acts as a test particle, right? So as long as it doesn't back react on the gravitational dynamics, you expect it to be independent of this fraction, and this is exactly what they see. So when this number is small, you get that this factor is predetermined, and we used it to calculate the d factors for the decay. This is the how do they call it, the grammage of the galaxy that contributes in to the efficiency of the of those decays. And when we include it, it happens only at around a few tens of kV, you start see the EV. So you start see this turnaround only at low masses. But they ran those simulations only for Milky Way sized galaxies. So we kept only constraints coming from Milky Way and Large Magellanic Cloud, the Large Magellanic Cloud. But constraints coming from smaller satellites, there is a recent constraint coming from hitting of a Leo T dwarf. And we don't have simulations for such small structure, so we just didn't use it because it wasn't too important for us. And running those simulations is not something we could possibly do and want or wanted to do. Okay, so this is the only place where the temperature, that we thought the temperature might come into. So this is the breakdown of the different constraints that we use, which come from XMM, Neustar, and Integral. This result came out the same day as our paper. So we published V2 the day after. So before this paper, this region, the day we posted our paper, this region was not around.
So the constraint for wonder matter, for instance, when people say constraint,
right.
Now, when people set constraints on freezing dark matter from like this warmness thingy, then the constraints that they get are stronger. They are like 20 kV.
Yes, but this is when it is the entirety of dark matter.
So
this is just a question, right? So what happens is that you get a suppression only at very small scales. So now it's the question is how much does it affect the integral along the line of sight?
I understand, but okay. What I get from that comparison is that the free streamingness of freezing dark matter is more than for standard warm dark matter.
Yes.
Therefore, this expression that you're using, that's calibrated to real warm dark matter, not like freezing dark matter.
Yeah, so I think that usually when you think about freezing dark, so our dark matter, because it's a UV kind of freezing, it looks very thermal. The distribution is very thermal. It looks much like a warm dark matter.
Like
so if you have if you have an IR freezing, usually you get a much broader spectrum and skew to the right.
But I thought you wanted the IR component.
No, we dropped the IR component. The IR component. So even when we take the most conservative assumptions for the UV freezing, the IR component is. Good. So yeah. So this is the constraint that we get from X-ray, and this is the breakdown into different experiments. Okay. Next, we said, okay, the thing that limits us from above, right? So the thing that stops us from going to higher coupling is the fact that the axion lifetime is too short, so we cannot look for it locally. So the next thing we looked at is what they call the spectrum of the universe. It's this nice paper that just studied the constraints on the intensity of photons across the different parts of the spectrum. And specifically, we looked at the UV and X-ray background because this is the part of parameter space that we could probe with it. And we just calculated the cosmological contribution to the photons, the cosmic photon backgrounds coming from X-ray decays. And we didn't do anything fancy, but we just required not to overproduce the upper bound on the, not to exceed the upper bound on the photon flux in the UV and X-ray part of the spectrum. And this is what we get here, right? So the reason you could go earlier is because earlier decays will also contribute. But if you are too early, if you decay too early, then you get too dilute and you leave this part of the spectrum and the constraints become So basically what happens is that at redshift above something like 5, at redshift above roughly 5, you don't really contribute much to the intensity of photons. I think I'm confusing things now. Yes, but basically if you look at the D factor of the universe, I need to explain what this D factor is because I said it already too many times. So basically, the thing that we care about when we do this X-ray constraints is the amount of density along the line of sight, something that looks like rho times ds, and we integrate over the line of sight or field of view or whatever. And when we do it in cosmology, we need to account for the same thing as before, right? So the E minus T, which is now a factor of Z, and this is going to be dS dZ dZ, and we can write it with the factors of Hubble and everything. But the second thing we need to take into account is the optical depth, which is also going to be a factor of Z. And I think that the reason it is cut off roughly there is that the optical depth kills you at redshift. So what happens is that before reionization that ends at redshift 5 or something, 5, 6, you have a lot of hydrogen atoms, and those energies have photoionizing energy, so the cross-section is really large, and everything, all the decays that happens before reionization are basically stopped. They don't reach the experiment today. They photoionize, and even if you have a photon going out of this process, it would be with much lower energy, which push it out of our parameter space. The next thing we looked at was CMB anisotropies. Okay, so this is basically just recasting constraint from Vivian Poulin and company, this paper, and Tracy Slater and Jiliang Wu. And both of them looked at the constraint on electromagnetic decays versus the fraction of dark matter that decays into those photons. So they give us basically, you get the constraint as a function of the lifetime, but you also get it as a function of the mass fraction. So this is basically what we needed in order to plot those constraints, right? Because for us, in each point in space, the coupling and the mass sets both the lifetime and the fraction. So each point in this parameter space is mapped into a constraint. So when we take those two things into consideration, we get that CMB anisotropies gives us this constraint. And this dashed line shows how larger would the constraint be, assuming Simon's observatory sensitivity. Yes. And as we said earlier, cosmology could contribute to spectral distortion and also lead to some constraints from BBN and effective. And those two have been studied for this irreducible fraction. So this is the spectral distortion constraints that has been studied in this paper. And the BBN constraints that you get, those two papers actually don't agree on what is the BBN constraints for this same irreducible fraction. So we took the smaller region. We didn't want to give the wrong impression. I think this paper finds like a bigger region, something like over here. But I don't know. I mean, I don't know how to settle this dispute for now. The only difference is that this paper assumed a reheat temperature of 10 MeV instead of 5 MeV. But as far as I can understand, this will not change this thing drastically. And regardless of that, this is a small region of the parameter space. So we are not too concerned about this. Good. So this is basically the constraints that we found on this parameter space, assuming that the axion exists in the spectrum. And because it exists, it will be produced in the early universe, even if in small fractions. And these are the constraints that we get from the different epochs. Now we can ask, so maybe now it's a good time to ask if anyone has any question about anything I said so far. So spectral distortion has to happen very early on. Right, so the spectral distortions, in principle, they could go to very high coupling, but I don't show it here. Is this what you're asking? Yeah, so they affect only very high. The spectral distortion era is much before the parameter space that we consider here. And once you cross this line, right, so this decouples roughly at a redshift of 300 or 600. And once you cross this time, this age of the universe, you can no longer generate spectral distortions, only anisotropies. You could do some things that would look like. Okay, so now what happens if you change earlier history? So let's start with this plot. And Here we just demonstrate what happens if you change the reheat temperature for 5 MeV to say 100 MeV. So we can see that, right, so in darker colors is the constraints I used to show. And by increasing the temperature, we just produce slightly more axions, and then you can constrain a slightly larger region. Okay, it allows us to go to even higher masses with CMB, which was kind of surprising to us. But yeah, so you see it doesn't change drastically the constraint, but it does change. And another thing that we wanted to talk about is that there is probably another irreducible contribution, but where it's much harder to say to make a precise statement. And the thing is that we expect to get some kind of contribution from the misalignment mechanism. So in order to make the, once again, the most ridiculous assumptions about the misalignment mechanism, we decided to assume that we had, before this reheating at 5 MeV, of course the universe existed, but in order to minimize the misalignment contribution to the axion density, we had to assume that the universe was matter dominated, because other forms when other forms of energy dominate the universe, you get the misalignment contribution would just be much larger. It can be shown that within known types of energies that could dominate the universe, the early matter domination is the most conservative in terms of minimizing this constraint parameter region, right? So now when you go and do it, you get, when you assume that the axion started oscillating, so the misalignment contribution to the density was set during matter domination, you get that the axion fraction, this FA that we calculate, is independent of the mass. And we get that this part of the parameter space is constrained by overclosing, right? So at very small coupling, you have more axions. And within those regions, you actually produce too much axions and you overclose the universe. And the different shades are for different initial misalignment angles, right? So what is the level of tuning you need to have? So if your initial misalignment is order one, then you get the darkest regions, this, this, and that. But if you tune it to one part in 10 or one part in 100, the constraint become weaker and weaker, right? And you could imagine how does it change if you tune it even farther, right? It just becomes smaller. So okay, do you have any questions about it? It's probably kind of surprising, why is the constraint just right? So the constraint is cut off from above, just like it was before, by the fact that it needs to decay after CMB is formed or after today, basically. So in the local universe, so this is the reason for the upper bound, and the reason it is independent. Sorry, it's just a constraint on the mass, right? So it seems that whenever the constraint exists, it only constrains the mass, is because the lifetime of the axion and the contribution that comes from the misalignment mechanism just cancels the coupling in it, right? So basically, I'll just erase those things. So we have that the constraint scales like rho over tau, the lifetime of the axion, which is basically this fraction over the lifetime. The lifetime scales like g squared m cubed the minus 1, which is basically decay constant squared over mass cubed, if we assume some decay constant. And FA scales like F squared. So if we take the ratio of those two, we get just something that scales like, that is a function of the mass, right? So rho over tau is just a function of the mass. Good. Then we can go and generalize, and we can start by just canceling the photon coupling, turning off the photon coupling. Maybe I should go to the Lagrangian for a second. Right, so now we're not considering this, but only the electron coupling. We're turning off the photon coupling. Yes, so we turn on the photon coupling, and in using this coupling, you could close an electron loop and attach two photons to it, and then you have effectively a loop level axion decaying into photons. And this is the thing that dominates the constraints below when the axion is lighter than two electrons, right? So you cannot produce two electrons on shell, so you have loop level decays into photons, and you still have X-ray, CMB anisotropies, and spectral distortion constraints. But once you cross the electron mass threshold, the lifetime of the axion becomes extremely shorter. So everything other than constraints of the decay of axion into electron positron pair in the CMB vanishes. So above the electron mass, we only have this tiny region. And then we can look at maybe slightly more theoretically motivated choice of parameters, which is the case where both GAE and GA gamma gamma are proportional to the same decay constant. So you assume maybe you could envision some UV completion that would give you some kind of this ratio of parameters. Then you get something very similar to the electron coupling case. So once again, so the decay into photon is now dominated by tree level process instead of a loop level. But once again, once the electron threshold is crossed, the lifetime becomes much shorter, and you only constrain the decay of the axion into electron positron pair. So far we just discussed axions, but it could apply to other kind of particles. We didn't focus on them much in our paper, but we do mention that sterile neutrinos could result in a similar kind of story, right? So if we have, I'm just assuming that we have an electron neutrino and a sterile neutrino that mixed with an angle theta, and then I can look at the constraints on the sterile neutrino mass or the fourth neutrino mass versus this mixing angle. And there you have a few different processes. So the lifetime is set by the three body decays into three electron neutrinos. And the signal is coming from this, once again, loop level decays into a neutrino and the photon. And we get some kind of a similar result. And this is basically it. Now I reach to my conclusion slide, if it can be produced. I think it shouldn't. I think it's just like so this is coming from we just used a paper that shows all those constraints, and they show it like this. But if you look at the paper that they cite, the plot is, so this is like the contour of the plot. So I think it is. Just no one, we didn't want to take it like too much higher coupling because no one has done it. But what we know about supernova at such light mass that usually, so probably constrained much. Yeah, I don't think that any of it is open, to be honest. And the spectral distortion is also, we changed the color here because we don't trust it as much as we trust the other constraints. The spectral distortion is like someone did like an analytic estimate, not us, in a paper. We took it from some paper and they did some analytic estimate, and it doesn't seem as robust as the other thing. This is like an appendix plot. We don't show it in the main body. We just wanted to show our constraints and how do they map in this assumption. But we do mention that probably this and that are a bit are not precise. And this was my conclusion. Yes. If it can be produced, it will be produced then. So meaning if it can be produced in stars and stuff like that, it might also be produced in a in cosmology, and then we can look for the things that were produced in cosmology. And sometimes they generate observable signals. Thank you. In mass? It's independent of mass. So, no, because, right, so I'm assuming that we started oscillating during metal domination. And if I want to ask when did this field started oscillating, then it started oscillating when H of M, when Hubble equals roughly the mass of the axion, right? So our metal domination ends at 5 MeV. And at 5 MeV, right? So in order for this to be true, it needs to start oscillating before 5 MeV. So there is a lower bound on the mass, which is MA needs to be larger than 10 to the minus 15 EV, because this is H at BBN. But then you could ask, okay, what happens at if it starts oscillating after BBN and before meta radiation equality, then you are probably, the constraint would be much stronger than that. Is there anyone on Zoom?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
There are no more questions.